Would you pray with me? God, we acknowledge this morning that everything we have and everything we are comes from you. The breath in our lungs, the food that we eat, the families we're blessed with, the vehicle that we drove to church this morning, and God, everything that we have belongs to you and came from you. And we give you thanks and we praise you this morning, God. But some of the things we deserve, we don't have. We don't have the guilt of our sin. We don't have shame. We have your love and your grace, and we praise you, God, together as one church in Christ's name. Amen. Have a seat. Good morning, everybody. So I was getting ready for this morning in my office this week. The thought occurred to me that every family, or almost every family, has what I'll call this morning an Uncle Steve in their family. They're that odd or semi-creepy family member who shows up at all the family gatherings. And while we don't treat the Uncle Steves in our life with contempt, we're often more than a little bit relieved when they decide they just can't make it to that birthday party or family celebration, right? It's just awkward to have Uncle Steve around. And everybody's a little more at ease when he's away from the party. Now, if you're sitting here this morning thinking to yourself, we don't have an Uncle Steve in our family, odds are pretty good you're the Uncle Steve. And that would be worth checking out. But somebody will tell you the truth. I think sometimes as Christians, we are guilty of putting the Old Testament law on par with Uncle Steve. In fact, let's just call it Uncle Law this morning. Reading it, talking about it, it's just kind of awkward. There's a lot of stuff that's hard to explain in the Old Testament. It makes us feel uncomfortable. Uncle Law has some weird-sounding rules and regulations, right? There's a lot of murder and sex and mayhem in the Old Testament. It bears a strong resemblance to Game of Thrones. And truth be told, we're all a little more comfortable when we can spend our days hanging around Jesus without Uncle Law around. But here's the problem with that perspective. Jesus loved the law. He breathed constantly. He breathed in the life-giving air of the Old Testament. He read it. He studied it. He memorized it. He trusted his Father through it, and he fought Satan with it. And even as he died on the cross, gasping for air, he found the strength to quote the law. Rather than distance himself from the Old Testament, Jesus, in his teaching, reaffirms it. In fact, in the Sermon on the Mount, he says, "Don't misunderstand why I've come. I didn't come to abolish the law of Moses or the writings of the prophets. No, I came to accomplish their purpose." Now, what Jesus did do throughout his teaching was correct the cultural misinterpretations of the law. Over centuries, the religious leaders of the Jewish people had reduced the law to this codex of manageable outward observances of the law. They, in the process, set a bar for following God that was impossibly high. And they lived it. Jesus said to the people, "Hey, I warn you, unless your righteousness exceeds that of the teachers of the law and the Pharisees, you're never going to enter the kingdom of heaven." That's tough to hear, because the Pharisees and the teachers were the epitome of ethical righteousness. Their scrupulous adherence to the written oral laws was legendary in Israel, and yet Jesus says all that adherence to the law doesn't buy them a ticket to heaven. If you're sitting there listening to Jesus that day, if you hear him say that, and you've been made all your life to feel beneath the Pharisees and the religious leaders, you got to ask yourself, is there any hope for me? How could I possibly be more righteous than them? But the people there that day missed the point. The Pharisees had gotten it all wrong. In God's upside-down economy, we don't become righteous by meticulously following a set of rules. We become righteous when we surrender all we are and all we have to God and let him change us from the inside out. So Jesus is teaching, and he walks up on this hillside and talks openly and honestly to people in the Sermon on the Mount about the struggle that we have in our life on two fronts, loving God and loving each other. Last week, Darren talked in his message about how grace changes our vertical relationship. Our relationship with God is dramatically different. Grace is a game changer in our relationship with God. And that thread runs through the Sermon on the Mount, but it's not the only impact God's grace is supposed to have on us. It should radically change how we treat other people, our friends, our family, even complete strangers. Jesus gets painfully honest in the Sermon on the Mount, and he gives examples that feel far too personal. In what amounts to a 20-minute talk, Jesus talks about all kinds of topics: raging anger, contempt, hatred, obsessive lust, divorce, verbal manipulation, revenge, physical violence, lawsuits, cursing, coercion, and begging. That's the stuff of the daily news. That's the stuff of life. And Jesus gets painfully specific about our struggle that we have to be good and do good in our relationships. And rather than heaping shame and guilt on us, Jesus offers hope. He holds out the very real prospect that we can truly treat each other with the same grace and love that God offers us. The bulk of the Sermon on the Mount can be broken down into 6 case studies about Old Testament law. And every one of them begins with this same formula. You've heard it was said, but I tell you. Jesus said, look, you know what the teachers and the religious leaders have been telling your families for generations. So let me be clear. I and I alone can accurately tell you what God's intent was when he gave the law. For instance, in Matthew 5, Jesus says, you've heard that our ancestors were told, you must not murder. If you commit murder, you're subject to judgment. But I say, and now he's going to come out with the truth about this, Jesus gives very concrete examples in what follows of 3 levels or 3 stages of anger that redefine this command about murder. Jesus says, if you're even angry with somebody, you're subject to judgment. Trying to think about what that kind of anger looks like and what Jesus really means here, I was reminded of a gift we were given a number of years ago. They called it Amish friendship bread, and it came in a little sack like this. It looks more like ectoplasm than it does a food source, right? It was this lump of foul-smelling goo. God only knows what's in that nasty little bag, right? And when people gave it to you, if you've ever gotten this, you know it's true. It's like you're joining some little weird cult that all has Amish friendship bread. They warn you that every 7 to 10 days, you have to feed this, which they call the starter. It's very appropriate for what it starts in your life. They don't tell you when you accept Amish friendship bread starters that it's eventually going to become like another child in your house. You have to feed it. You have to tend to it. Every 7 to 10 days, you have to take some out, and you have to make bread, because it'd be wasteful to throw this away, right? And if you're gone on vacation, you have to arrange for friends or family members to come into your home and feed this starter, because if you don't feed it, it'll die. Really? That's a great picture of the anger that Jesus is talking about here. It's not just this momentary flash reaction. It's not a simple outburst of anger. The anger he's describing here with this Greek word is an ongoing, growing anger. You take that anger in, and it becomes a part of you. It begins to consume your thoughts. It finds its way to pepper your speech in every conversation. And in order to maintain that level of anger, you have to do what? You got to feed it. You got to nurse it. You've got to prop it up with more data and more judgments and more vitriol, because if you don't feed it, what's going to happen? It'll die. Jesus is clear. If you're nursing that kind of anger in your heart, it's the same as murder. But it doesn't stop there. He says, if you call somebody an idiot, you're in danger of being brought before the court. And if you curse someone, like literally, if you say to them, you can go to hell, you're in danger of the fires of hell yourself. Some of you, as you look at your Bible, instead of the word idiot, will have the Aramaic word that's just written out in English for us, raka. It's an expression of contempt that's hard to translate. It takes anger to a whole new level. It assigns a value to another person's life and meaning. And you basically are saying, your life is completely worthless. You are a waste of good air. Our everyday world is filled with that kind of anger. He's an idiot. She's a moron. What a worthless jerk. And I'm sure if we had time just to brainstorm a top 10 list, we'd come up with a lot worse together that we've heard our friends say. We smear our raka words on criminals, on the elderly, on ethnically different people, the uneducated, the overeducated, on men, on women, on immigrants, on addicts, on people with mental illness, and on just about anyone who's on the wrong side of an issue from us. We mumble these words under our breath. We hurl them with anger in the workplace, in our homes, or as we drive. We post them on social media for all the world to see. And it breaks my heart every time I see in social media where someone has smeared someone with raka, devaluing either an individual or an entire people group. Is there a better way to live? Jesus says, absolutely. And it starts with that simple seed of do not murder. Plant that seed in your heart, Jesus says, and don't murder people. Don't assassinate their character. Treat them with respect and dignity. Show others the same grace and love and forgiveness that God has shown to you. So think about your conversation over the last couple of weeks. How did you talk about the issues that were coming up? How did you decide who should and shouldn't get grace? When you talked about the kid who shot 33 people, killing 17 in Parkland, Florida, does he deserve grace? Does his family deserve grace? Do the surviving victims, as they lash out at this troubled kid, do the family of those victims deserve grace? The answer is yes. Grace extends to all of them. Bring it a little closer to home. How have you talked in the last couple of weeks about the shooting that happened on I-90? Where whatever the circumstances are, a family lost a daughter. How'd you talk about that? Was it seasoned with grace towards her, towards the officers involved, towards the people who are protesting, towards the city officials who are either dealing or not dealing with the issue? Again, the only answer Jesus would give in all of these, not talking about who's right or wrong, is that we need to extend grace. It flows freely from God to them. And when we have an opportunity to choose a side in an argument, we should choose grace. This is really important stuff. Our ability to live in and extend grace is a really accurate gauge of our understanding of God's grace to us. If we can't forgive somebody, if we nurture anger and resentment, it actually begins to block our relationship with God. It puts this solid barrier in our relationship that God says we have to deal with it. To show us just how important this is, Jesus goes on in Matthew 5 and says, look, even if you're in the middle of a worship service and you realize you've hurt somebody, or you realize you've treated them with disrespect, or you've been feeling your anger towards them building, leave. And this was a big deal as Jesus taught it, because he's talking about them worshiping in the temple. It was a pilgrimage. It was a several-day journey to get to the temple. And Jesus says, if you've made that several-day journey and gone to great expense and you find yourself in worship and there's something not right in your relationships, leave. Go. Go and be reconciled to that person, and then come and offer your sacrifice to God. Relational integrity is so important, it can't wait. Do it now. Jesus commands us to take positive steps to heal those relationships in our lives that are broken or damaged. And all that fruit grows from one little Old Testament seed. Don't murder. Jesus blows the doors wide open on that one, and he explains God's heart on this. A few verses later, he's taught on some other things, and he circles back to this because it's so important in our lives. He teaches on the integrity in our relationships, and this actually is one of the toughest things that he says in the entire Sermon on the Mount. Not because it's hard to understand. It's really clear. It's just hard to do. You've heard that the law says the punishment must match the injury. An eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. And that's true. The law did say that. But the law set the maximum penalty, not the mandatory penalty. Jesus goes on to say, but I say, now he starts to invade our space, don't resist an evil person. If they slap you on the right cheek, offer the other cheek as well. Understand the physicality of that comment. Most people are right-handed. If I'm going to smack you on your right cheek with my right hand, how am I going to do that? Backhanded, right? It's not like you're taking a direct punch. It's more of an affront to our dignity. It's more of an insult than anything else. And Jesus said, if you're insulted, if your dignity's challenged, don't fight back. If you're sued in court and your shirt's taken from you, give him your coat too. If a soldier demands you carry his gear for a mile, carry it too. Give to those who ask, and don't turn away from those who want to borrow. This was a radical new way to deal with the affronts and the injuries and the impositions in our life. And Jesus asks us not to make the normal human response, not to follow our first human reaction, but to offer instead a kingdom response, one that comes out of recognition of God's unmerited favor in our lives. Reading these four statements often causes two very different reactions in people. Some people throw up their hands in despair. There's just no way I can do this, God. I've never backed down from a fight in my life, whether it's a physical fight or a court fight or a political fight. That's not me. Others react by turning it into this pit of grinding legalism. And they read these as laws we must follow, regardless of whatever else is going on in the situation. It's really important to remember, as you read Jesus' words, he's not replacing the Old Testament law with a set of harsher, more stringent laws. We're not talking here about things that we have to do in order to be saved, or things that we have to do in order to be a Christian. Jesus is simply describing here what it would look like for us to live in full appreciation of the grace that God has extended to us and begin to model that in our everyday life. He's giving us in glorious detail what it means to have a righteousness that exceeds the righteousness of the Pharisees. And that kind of life doesn't come by strict adherence to a law. It comes when we understand what our life would look like without God's grace. Just how poor and broken we really are spiritually. And when we get that, then our relationships and our lives will be very different, because we'll live out of a deep appreciation for how God's grace has shaped us and changed us and remade us. Look, I get it. There are people in our lives who don't deserve grace. That's kind of the definition of it. Grace is always undeserved. From God, we deserve anger and we get love. We deserve punishment and we get forgiveness. That's grace. And once we understand that central truth, it begins to change us. I'll be honest, that change is not always easy. It's not easy to live extending grace every day. When somebody hurts my wife, somebody hurts my kids, somebody hurts my grandkids, my first response isn't always grace. When I'm riding my motorcycle and the third or fourth driver pulls out in front of me without looking to see that I'm coming, it's really hard for the words that come out of my mouth to be grace. When somebody cuts in front of me in line at the grocery store, or worse yet, in the TSA check line at the airport, grace isn't the first thing that comes out of me. It's a lot closer to justice. It's not easy to live this life of grace in our relationships that Jesus asks us to. But here's my prayer for you and for me. I want to walk with Jesus long enough that I begin to look like him. You know, kind of the same way that people who've been a couple for decades start to look like each other, which isn't great news for my wife. It's what happens with longtime friends who hang around each other so long that they begin to mimic, unknowingly, mimic each other's actions and phrases. I want to hang out so closely with Jesus that that happens, that his thoughts become my thoughts, that his reaction to things that happen in life become my natural reaction. I want to walk so closely with Jesus that I treat people the way he did. I see people the way he sees people. I want grace. I want grace to become a normal, natural part of my life. And I pray that for you too. That the presence of Jesus in your life will show up in how you react with your family, with your neighbors, the people you work with, and with total strangers. That God's grace will be so evident in all of our lives that people will know he's been with Jesus. She's been with Jesus. And that presence has changed them deeply. And when that happens, it will point people to the amazing grace of God that changed us radically from the inside out.